This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has met the UN chief and Turkey's leader in Ukraine. Little progress was reported on expanding Ukraine's grain exports. The volatile situation at the Russian-occupied nuclear power plant and efforts to help end the war. It was Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's first visit to Ukraine since the outbreak of the war and the second by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The leaders also discussed exchanges of prisoners of war and a proposed UN fact-finding mission to a prison in Russian-occupied Ukraine, where 53 POWs were killed last month. Two Russian villages on the border with Ukraine have been evacuated after a fire broke out at a nearby munitions depot. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The blaze erupted at a munitions warehouse near Ukraine's northeastern border with Russia, near the village of Timonovo. The fire is the latest in a series of destructive incidents on Russian-occupied territory in Ukraine or inside Russia itself. It comes days after another ammunition depot exploded on Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea. Crimea is a Russian-occupied territory seized by Moscow in 2014. Last week, 9 Russian warplanes were also destroyed in Crimea. The incident demonstrated Ukraine's ability to penetrate deep inside Russian-occupied territory and Russia's apparent vulnerability. Ukraine has stopped short of publicly claiming responsibility. I'm Karen Chamas.
The war will hit the 7-month mark on the 24th of August. Find more on these stories at voanews.com or follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. A British man nicknamed one of the Beatles by his captives because of his English accent has been sentenced to life in prison for his role in the deaths of 4 U.S. hostages captured by the Islamic State. Prosecutors say El-Shahif El-Sheikh is the most notorious member of the Islamic State ever to be convicted at a trial in U.S. court. The jury found him guilty of hostage-taking resulting in the deaths of Americans James Foley, Stephen Sotloff, Peter Kasich, and Kayla Mueller. All but Mueller were executed in a videotaped beheading circulated online. His lawyer said Friday that they will appeal the conviction. The European Medicines Agency said a smaller dose of the monkeypox vaccine appears to be effective and can be used to stretch the current supply by 5 times. Echoing a recommendation made earlier this month by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. In a statement on Friday, the EU drug regulator said injecting people with just 1/5 of the regular dose of the smallpox vaccine appeared to be equally protective. Users of Apple iPhones, iPads, and Macs have been warned of a serious security flaw, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Threat intelligence advisor Jamie Collier calls it a zero-day vulnerability.
Exploited by a hacker before the company, in this case Apple, have detected it and been able to do something about it.
Apple says the vulnerability is a hacker could possibly run any software in a user's name.
We see vulnerabilities being announced all the time. Maybe the slight difference here is it has been exploited, but we've not seen any evidence of widespread exploitation.
It's not known who exploited this vulnerability and how it's been exploited. The message to affected users is to update their software.
Apple is very similar to any of the large technology companies. I think what's important here is that they have made that update available, and it seems that they've done that really quickly.
Affected devices include the iPhone 6S and later models, several models of the iPad, including all iPad Pros, and Mac computers running Mac OS Monterey. I'm Ed Donahue.
Recapping our top story, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has met the UN chief and Turkey's leader in Ukraine. Little progress was reported on expanding Ukraine's grain exports, the volatile situation at the Russian-occupied nuclear power plant, and efforts to help end the war. It was Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's first visit to Ukraine since the outbreak of the war and the second by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The leaders also discussed exchanges of prisoners of war and a proposed fact-finding mission to a Russian-occupied prison where 53 POWs were killed last month. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Ethiopian Airlines issued a statement on Friday which said communication with the pilots had been lost, adding that the concerned crew had been removed from operation pending further investigation.
That's Henry Wilkins reporting on news that two Ethiopian Airlines pilots might have fallen asleep in the cockpit. Details coming up. Also, today is World Humanitarian Day, a day set aside to honor aid workers all over the world. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with breaking news. Loud explosions have been heard in the past few hours near the Hyatt Hotel in Mogadishu, the Somali capital. VOA Somali Service reports suicide car bombers rammed into the hotel and that a witness reports a gun battle between attackers and security forces. It is not yet clear if there are casualties. The Islamist group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the blasts, but that has not been confirmed. Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, warns that Tunisia faces an economic crisis and that the economy, which has struggled since the revolution, is close to collapse. She says the international community can help, but she called on foreign powers to condemn Kais Saied's power grab to halt long-term damage to the country. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed Tunisia's challenges with her.
First of all, Tunisia needs to rebuild the trust of the international community that really deteriorated due to Saied's anti-democratic behavior over the past year. Many of Tunisia's traditional donors have really been reticent to support Tunisia due to the instability and the uncertainty that Saied's coup has brought to the country. So in the near term, Tunisia really needs to sign the IMF deal that's been under negotiation to unlock some of that investment. But they also need to rein in inflation and get the public sector wage bill under control. Luckily, tourism has started to come back. That's a good sign. We've started to see some improvement there. But the country continues to face very high levels of unemployment, as well as unsustainable food and fuel prices. And they really need some investment from the international community quickly in order to help address these problems.
Tunisian President Kais Saied dissolved the parliament, sacked the prime minister, and declared himself chief executive on July 25 of last year, then ratified a constitution that lacked any kind of checks and balances. Statements from foreign actors have so far failed to condemn Saied's anti-democratic and extra-legal actions. What should the United States in particular do to get Tunisia's democracy back on track?
I think, first of all, the most recent statement that the U.S. government put out following the referendum actually takes the right approach. They did not congratulate Tunisia for the referendum and focus their attention on the Tunisian people and the pro-democracy activists. I think that's the way that they should continue to approach Tunisia. But that said, the statements alone are not sufficient to pressure Saied. They really need to marry statements with action. And that action, if they want to actually have an influence on Saied, needs to isolate him and his government by shifting funding away from the government towards actors committed to democracy. You know, the sort of backbone of the U.S.-Tunisia relationship is based on shared democratic. Saied has erased those values. And without those values, the United States should make clear that it will not support Saied's government, but also should continue and double down on support for the pro-democracy activists like civil society actors and the media.
Did the U.S. invite President Saied to Africa conference in Washington?
Yes, there have been reports that the U.S. extended an invitation for President Saied to attend the U.S.-Africa summit in Washington in December. I don't think we should read too much into this, though. They are inviting all of the heads of state from the African continent. And, you know, while there are many issues clearly with Saied's behavior, this should not be read as a reward for Saied. Rather, it's just a pro forma invitation to all the heads of state, many of whom in the continent are not democratic or not democracy activists themselves. So this is by no means signaling out Saeed or sort of giving him any sort of reward.
You stated that the European Union and its member states are Tunisia's largest benefactors and that these actors should use their influence to get Saeed to quickly relinquish his unlawful power grab and reinstall a legitimate government and an elected parliament. What's needed from the European Union to achieve such a goal?
Over the past few months, Europe has increasingly kind of shied away from its harsh criticism of Tunisia, whereas they were largely in lockstep with the United States in the first 6 months of the post-coup. They've gotten far more concerned about their own domestic issues, particularly migration, than promoting democracy in Tunisia. I think, however, that this is a really short-sighted view. The kind of long-term stability and prosperity in Tunisia, which is going to lead to decreased migration, is only going to come about from a government where the people have a voice and where there's pluralism and accountability. Saeed's model of consolidating power into the hands of a strong presidency is not going to bring about the short or long-term growth and stability that Tunisia needs. So it's actually more in Europe's interest to push Saeed to return the country to a democratic path. And to do so, again, I think they should be withholding assistance to his government, whereas they should be continuing to support the Tunisian people. And also they should be consistently and loudly criticizing his anti-democratic steps. The kind of return to business as usual that they've, this approach that they've taken over the past several months is not beneficial to Tunisia. And it's also not beneficial to Europe in the short or the long term.
That was Sarah Yerkes with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. The French news agency AFP says firefighters in Algeria are bringing under control forest blazes that have killed at least 38 people. The Wire Service reports that a fire service spokesman says some of the worst hit areas, including El Tarf and Souk Ahrad, are under control, although 16 fires are still burning across 7 districts. The Justice Ministry has launched an investigation into allegations that some of the fires are linked to arson and 4 suspects have been arrested. Authorities say 1,700 firefighters are working to control the fires that are still raging. Critics say the government is poorly prepared to fight forest fires, which have become increasingly common during hot summer months. Ethiopian Airlines has suspended the crew of a flight where both pilots reportedly fell asleep and missed their landing window in Addis Ababa. The plane eventually landed safely, but experts say the incident raises questions about pilot fatigue on the airline, the largest air carrier in Africa. Henry Wilkins reports from Addis Ababa.
The Aviation Herald, a news website for the aviation industry, reported Thursday that two pilots flying an Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 from Sudan's capital Khartoum to Addis Ababa had fallen asleep and missed their landing. After overflying the runway, the autopilot disconnected. The disconnect wailer woke the crew up, who then manoeuvred the aircraft for a safe landing, the report said. The incident is alleged to have happened on August 15th. Ethiopian Airlines issued a statement on Friday which said communication with the pilots had been lost, adding that the concerned crew had been removed from operation pending further investigation. Appropriate corrective action will be taken based on the outcome of the investigation. Safety has always been and will continue to be our first priority. The statement did not say whether the pilots had been sleeping. Experts say the incident raises questions about pilot fatigue and could be a result of the airline overworking the pilots or other external factors. Hassan Shahidi is an expert at the Flight Safety Foundation, an independent non-profit. He told VOA that pilot fatigue
will be investigated in terms of exactly how many hours they were flying and potentially whether fatigue or scheduling may have played a role in this. But it is at the end of the day the responsibility of the crew, if they are fatigued or if they're tired, to report that they're tired.
Airlines which fly in and out of the US and European Union, as the Ethiopian Airlines does, are bound by safety rules set by regulatory bodies in those jurisdictions. Failure to meet those rules means airlines can be banned from flying to US and EU destinations. The EU aviation regulator, the European Union Aviation Safety Agency, ESA, told VOA via email it is aware of the incident. It said the agency evaluates information from many sources as part of its continuous monitoring
of non-EU air carriers and takes action as appropriate to ensure operations meet our safety expectations. The agency said it does not comment on individual cases. Experts said a single incident like this is unlikely to jeopardise an airline's ability to fly to the US and EU. Sean Mendes is an expert on aviation in Africa.
Oh, this is definitely not the first time that both crew have been known to fall asleep in the cockpit during flight. In fact, just a few months ago, there was an ITA Airlines flight transatlantic where both crew were found to have fallen asleep over France.
Ethiopian Airlines is Africa's largest carrier and, according to experts, has a good safety record. Mendes went on to add,
I would not hesitate to fly on Ethiopian myself. I was on two Ethiopian Airlines flights this week already. I've got another one booked for the next few weeks. And, you know, Ethiopian does remain one of the safest airlines in Africa and indeed in the world.
The outcome of the investigation is expected to come quickly as Ethiopian Airlines attempted to dispel passenger concerns over safety. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Next Wednesday, Angola holds parliamentary elections, which will lead to the selection of the country's next president. How are preparations going on so far? How is the mood in the country? Those are some of the questions I asked Mayra Fernandez with VOA's Portuguese to Africa service, who is in Angola's capital, Luanda, covering the election.
Yeah, yes, thank you so much for having me. I've been here in Luanda, it has been 5 days. We are actually 5 days away from the election date, August 24th, and the environment is it's a bit tense. There's some nervousness around among voters. People are very anxious because they believe this election is different, feels different. The people that I talked with, they say we have to remember that for the first time, two main parties running are really close. You know, the popularity that the opposition leader from UNITA, Adalberto Costa Jr., has, especially among the youth, it's big. Most of the people that are going to vote this year, they are between 18 and 24 year old. Actually, a lot of people that I talked with, civil society, analysts, observers, they say that the change is already happening because we are seeing an engagement that we haven't seen before.
You're talking about the majority of the populace that will be voting are, you said, between the ages of 18 and 24. Will that actually favor UNITA's charismatic leader, Adalberto Costa Jr., who is drawing massive crowds at his political rallies?
I would say so. If we just look at the facts, we don't know exactly what's going to happen now. I mean, we don't really know what's going to happen when people get to the ballots, right? And maybe they'll change their minds. But there's two things that we need to look at on this process that people have been highlighting for me. One is that these people that we are talking about, these young people, they have no memory of war because they never lived it. So the rhetoric of UNITA that was once the guerrilla movement doesn't resonate with these people. So what they are looking at is someone that they feel that understands their needs. João Lourenço, in 2017, he ran on several issues, and one of them was creating employment. And unemployment among the youth is the biggest in Angola. So when he said that he would create this 500,000 job, people halfway his mandate were asking, where are those jobs?
Okay, so we have João Lourenço, the handpicked predecessor of José Eduardo dos Santos, the former president, who recently died in Spain, by the way. And we have Adalberto Costa Jr., who is the charismatic leader you just talked about. But one other interesting fact is we have a woman candidate in 30 years for the first time running for the presidency. Can you talk a little about her? Who is she?
Florbela Malaquias. Florbela Malaquias, or simply Bela Malaquias, she is a lawyer. She was also a journalist. She created this party now that is the Humanista Party, so we'll focus on the human being. And she's running on the slogan that Mama has come, hunger is gone. Mm. So she promises to end hunger in Angola, which we know has been more and more a big issue, not just because of economic reasons, but also climate change has been affecting, especially in the south. The communities in the south are suffering a lot, 7 years. And this is her slogan, is that she's going to end hunger. It's curious that the first woman that ran was in 1992. There was the first elections that Angola held, and it took 30 years, even though Angola only had 5 electoral processes so far, for someone else to come. But also, it's not only this woman running, but there's also a big list of women running for parliament, and very young women.
That was Mayra Fernandez with VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. She talked to me from Angola's capital, Luanda. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Ghana has raised its benchmark interest rate to a record high 22% as the country struggles to check soaring prices caused in part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ghana is also trying to boost its currency, the cedi, which saw the second worst drop in value globally after Sri Lanka's rupee. The high cost of living sparked street protests in July and talks with the International Monetary Fund for a bailout, which Ghanaians hope comes soon, as Kenneth Mensah reports from Accra.
The cost of food and services has more than doubled in Ghana, as inflation hit 31.7% annually in July, its highest since late 2003. Consumers and business people say they are being pushed out of business, as the local currency continues to lose its value against the US dollar. Nakuchi is a 45-year-old mother of 5 who runs a cold store business in the capital, Accra. She told VOA she is losing money as prices of goods keep soaring, adding the government has failed. She says, prices of goods keep rising. We cannot afford to buy them anymore to also sell. She says, we are suffering. What is happening? We had a lot of hopes in this government, she says. But it is so embarrassing how things keep getting worse daily. Addressing the Methodist Church of Ghana on Thursday, President Nana Akufo-Addo said his government is not sleeping on the job.
Ravages of the pandemic, worsened by the effects of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, have led to spiraling freight charges, rising fuel costs, high food prices, steep inflationary spikes, and widespread business failure. I am fully aware these are very difficult times for us in Ghana, just as they are for most people in the world. However, the Akufo-Addo government has not thrown its hands up in despair at this pernicious development.
The president says he is optimistic the economy will bounce back and will bring relief to Ghanaians.
We're determined to bring relief to the Ghanaian people. Other steps will be taken, in particular, to deal with the unacceptable depreciation of the cedi, reining in inflation by bringing down food prices is a major preoccupation of the government. This season's emerging successful harvest will assist us achieve this objective, together with other policies.
Courage Kinsley-Marty, the senior economist with Data Bank Research, told VOA the measures taken by the central bank at its emergency meeting Wednesday to address the free fall of the cedi are appropriate.
The central bank's target is to bring inflation down. And what we all want as citizens is to have low and stable inflation. In doing so, there are going to be short-term consequences or trade-offs. Businesses and individuals who would love to have access to cheaper funds or capital may not be able to do that, but that would have to be the cost we have to bear in the short term.
Godfred Buckman, a professor of finance at the University of Ghana, urged Akufo-Addo to reduce the size of his government as a further cut on spending.
Time is not on our side, right? Government needs to reduce the size of government drastically, right? Also as a signal and be able to have greater control over expenditure from that side.
Time is running out for the government as Ghanaians continue to wait with bated breath, hoping for a major economic turnaround ahead of a hike in utility prices taking effect on 1st September. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Today, despite all the modern tools we have at our disposal, we're experiencing the worst global food security crisis I have ever seen, said U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield. In Africa, one out of every five people is undernourished, one in five.
Food insecurity means families are not able to provide for their children. It means children not getting the nutrition they need to succeed at school. And in the worst cases, it means famine. And famine means death.
That's why we have to be determined to stamp out hunger. To do that, she said, we must look at what is driving food insecurity in the first place.
I see four clear causes, what I call the E and the three C's: energy, climate, COVID, and conflict.
Energy prices have gone up in the past year, and because energy is indispensable in food production, high energy prices mean more expensive food. The first C stands for climate change.
The climate crisis is a crisis of natural disasters, of floods and storms and heat waves, but it also directly leads to food security crisis.
The second C is COVID. COVID-19 gave us an immediate and additional shock to the system, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. Before COVID, 100 million people were food insecure. 3 years later, just in 3 years, that number jumped to over 190 million people. Then there is a third C, which I believe is the most insidious source of hunger, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. That is hunger caused by conflict, hunger that is caused intentionally, hunger used as a weapon of war. All of these problems, energy, climate, COVID, and conflict, combine into a complex cocktail that has led to the worst hunger crisis of our lifetimes, said Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield. Finally, because conflicts can weaponize hunger and force people to leave their homes, which puts strains on the food systems of surrounding countries, Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield announced more than $127 million in additional humanitarian assistance to support refugees, asylum seekers, internally displaced persons, stateless persons, and persecuted people across Africa. Now is the moment to work together across governments, across countries, between people to end hunger, she said. Now is the moment to forge partnerships with civil society, the private sector, to galvanize the diaspora, to take advantage of new technologies and better techniques, to build the food systems and the structures of the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.